You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our March 2026 book club pick, Butter, a novel of food and murder by Asako Yusaki and translated by Polly Barton. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by you, our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon member, you gain access to our members-only Discord server, where you chat with me, Rira, and our fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick. Definitely appreciate everyone who has joined us on Patreon so far, and hope to see a lot more of you there in the future. Before we get into Butter, just a quick spoiler warning. During our book club discussions, we do discuss our book club pick in its entirety, including all character moments and plot twists. So if you have not finished Butter yet and don't want to be spoiled on some of the twisty things that happen in this book, this is your cue to hit pause on the podcast, finish the book, and come back and listen to our discussion afterwards.
And some trigger warnings before our discussion: fat phobia, misogyny, and a brief mention of sexual assault on a minor. So if any of those are triggering to you, just approach the book with caution. All right, so let's get into it, and we'll start off with the book jacket as always. Gourmet cook Manako Kaji sits in the Tokyo detention house, convicted of the serial murders of lonely businessmen, whom she is said to have seduced with her delicious home cooking. The case has captured the nation's imagination, but Kaji refuses to speak with the press, entertaining no visitors. That is until journalist Rika Machida writes a letter asking for her recipe for beef stew, and Kaji can't resist writing back. Rika, the only woman in her news office, works late each night, rarely cooking more than ramen. As the visits unfold between her and the steely Kaji, they are closer to a masterclass in food than journalistic research. Rika hopes this gastronomic exchange will help her soften Kaji, but it seems that Rika might be the one changing. Do she and Kaji have more in common than she once thought? Inspired by the real case of a convicted con woman and serial killer, the Konkatsu Killer, Asako Yuzuki's Butter is a vivid, unsettling exploration of misogyny, obsession, romance, and the transgressive pleasures of food in Japan. So, Butter by Asako Yuzuki, it originally published in Japan in 2017, and it was translated by Polly Barton in the UK in 2024. So we are reading this book 2 years after it created a really big splash internationally. I remember seeing this book literally displayed everywhere. And I think when I was in London, yeah, it was around 2024, that was where I saw a lot of the displays of this book. And it's really funny that it was so celebrated in the UK and also eventually the US. The US edition is also translated by Polly Barton. It's written in British format. So while you're reading, you'll be like, why is the quotations weird? Why is the spelling weird? It's because it's British. But it's funny that the book was received so well overseas, but in Japan, it kind of received polarizing views. Yeah, it won the Naoki Prize the year that it came out, but the Japanese public were a little bit torn. They were saying, this book it's too harsh, it's too feminist, it's too blah, blah, blah. So I thought it was really funny because this book is kind of like a scathing reflection on what misogyny does to Japanese women, and the public's reaction to it is like,
yeah,
it just proves that this book is very important.
Yeah, I also find it interesting that it got so much buzz overseas, because this is a very, like, it's a very Japanese book. It's about very Japanese things. And I guess it just goes to show that, like, it's easier to, like, be judgmental or critical of other cultures than your own. But at the same time, like, a lot of the stuff that happens in this book resonated with me, and as well as our book club members, when you reflect on what's happening in our own countries, especially in the West, right? And it's, I think it's so interesting. So when this book was pitched, or when you first pitched this book, it was like, it's a book about murder and food. And so,
it says the subtitle for this book, I have a copy right here. It says A Novel of Food and Murder. So yeah. Can you blame me? And also it was pitched to me by many people on like marketing as like a murder mystery. Right. And it's not that. So let's just get that out of the way. Yeah, this is not a thriller.
It's not a murder mystery. It actually has more in common with one of our other recent book club picks on Kim Ji-yeon, Born 1982, which was also itself a scathing commentary on misogyny and gender roles in Korea that also created a polarizing reaction, right?
Yeah.
But I would say this book was definitely a little bit more thrilling than Kim Ji-yeon. Kim Ji-yeon was very like, matter of fact, this is how the patriarchy screws up women. And this book also explores how the patriarchy, how gender roles, how like culture, how society, how rigid traditional culture screws up both men and women, but especially the women, right? But with the added like kind of hook of a possible serial killer.
Yeah, so the author Asako Yuzuki, in her interview with The Guardian, she mentioned that, you know, she was inspired by the real life case of the Konkatsu killer.
Konkatsu in Japanese means marriage hunting. So the marriage hunting
killer. Yeah, marriage hunting killer.
Yeah.
And this case spanned from like 2007 to like the 2010s. Kanae Kijima is pretty much the real life version of Kaji. And she had three would-be husbands, and she poisoned all of them, and she defrauded, like, so many other men. And there are other, like, unidentified victims that is, you know, police are saying it's probably her, but we don't have proof. But Asako Yuzuki said that she wasn't really following the case, and she didn't really know much about it. But what really captured her attention was the misogyny against Kanae Kijima. So she was just like, huh, here's this woman who possibly allegedly murdered all these men and stole all their money. And people are more obsessed with the way she looks and how, you know, she's not conventionally attractive by Japanese standards. And people are saying there's no way she could have seduced all these men. There's no way, like, these men fell for her charms. What charm? She looks like that. And she was just really fascinated by just how society reacted to this case. And that is why she started writing this book. And I can definitely see a lot of that in this book, because it's not so much about the case. I originally thought, from the premise of like, okay, this is about like a journalist interviewing a serial killer, that maybe the journalist is going to piece together the clues in this case and either find out that Kaji is not guilty or guilty, like something will be solved. And
yeah,
it's
I was
not
thinking
that.
It would end up being either like a Hannibal situation where it's like the inmate corrupts the investigator, or like a Kaiser Soze type thing, right? Where she gets off, it's actually like guilty, right? Which could still go either way. We'll get to how everything resolves. But I think what took a little getting used to while reading the book was just coming to terms with like the fact that the serial killing or the serial killer case is the setting, and the actual story is kind of more of this coming of age for our main character, Rika.
Yeah. Also, like, before we get into, like, the meat of the story, I think it's hilarious that when this book came out and people were talking about it, the actual killer, Kanae Kijima, she heard about it, and she fucking hates this book. So, I just thought that would be like a funny anecdote to add. Like, she called it like theft of her life, and I was just like, okay, it's not about you, but that's like a classic narcissist take on it. Yeah.
I mean, we could talk about it when we eventually get to talking about Kaji, because there's a lot of like, or do you just want, well, let's get to Kaji first. Like, the story opens with Rika, our main character, who is this journalist at a men's weekly magazine, going to dinner with her best friend and her husband. And so, you know, in this initial like dinner party, not really dinner party, this initial friends dinner scene, we get a lot of background on Rika, on Reiko and their relationship, as well as what Rika does for work, which is for her to report on the things that she gets assigned to, which is a lot of like politics work. She has to do a lot of entertaining. And so we keep coming back to this theme where like women are like they're called upon to do a lot of like serving men in all aspects of their career as professionals and as like in the home.
Yeah, like in their society, it seems that the default for women is to be someone who serves men, someone who is always going to be the one doing the quote unquote domestic duties. Like serving tea, making sure that events run smoothly, making sure that things are organized for the men who are in charge. And you would think that they're competent enough to do all the work that they assign women. But no, it's, you know, culturally in their minds are like, it's a woman's job. So why would a man do it? And it is funny to see the variations of like men in this book, because there are men who are staunchly traditionally Japanese with like very strict gender roles, and then you have men who think that they are very liberal and are very pro, like very feminist in their views of like what a woman can do in their career and in their place in the home, but at the same time it is very much rooted in misogyny, because like how can you, it is systemic. Okay, so how do you fix that? Everybody is kind of trapped under the patriarchy in this book. And even when you are considered one of the quote unquote good ones, you're not.
Yeah, I think that I found that really interesting in how it's portrayed through Reiko, Rika's best friend, who had a great job, but decided to leave in order to focus on getting pregnant, becoming a mother. And it's Rika has like this very relatable, like I don't know if everyone has had this experience, but I think a lot of us understand the feeling of like not being happy with our friend's choice of partner.
I don't think it was that she was disappointed by Reiko's choice of partner. I think she was disappointed that like she was giving so much up for a guy, because to her, like, obviously, this also stems from a way of patriarchal thinking, even though, you know, it is also feminist. Her being like we worked so hard to get like equal rights, or I mean, it's definitely not equal, but like we worked so hard so that women could have careers. This is progress. And you want to just give that up to be a homemaker? And that is a very like, also misogynist way of looking at things, but that is what she thinks. She's like, my friend is super talented, super smart, and she's capable and ambitious, and I just cannot believe she's gonna settle for this homemaker life. And there's nothing wrong with being a homemaker, but this just doesn't fit her, right? And we find out that like Reiko, it's not so much that she really wants this domestic life. It's that she's kind of rebelling against what her parents' marriage was like. And she is like, she has put so much expectations on what marriage should be like that it is also ruining her marriage. Yeah. So that is something we'll get into a little bit later, because we're talking about Rika. But yeah.
For sure. Like, and also in Kaji, right? Because like it's, everyone in this book is effed over by like traditional gender roles, right? Like, Reiko is kind of she's trapped because she is trying to fit herself into the traditional gender roles. And then, at least in my opinion, Kaji is kind of using traditional gender roles to like to do her grift, to do her cons, right? And they're both utilizing the same constraints that they are given, but like in different ways.
Yeah, and something interesting about Rika's job is that because she has to follow up on sources, because she has to, you know, play the boys club game, you know, there are two ways to go up the ladder in her profession. One is to be extremely competent and just be one of the boys, right? And then the other way is to use your femininity to get ahead, aka sleep your way up the ladder, sleep with your sources. And of course, that is frowned upon. But yeah, this profession, this industry is so, like, they are so exclusionary. They do not want women at any editorial positions. They don't want them to have any power in what gets chosen to go out into the public. So Rika, she doesn't want to be in a position where she uses her femininity to her advantage. She actually goes the opposite way. She makes sure she doesn't wear makeup. She, you know, is very tomboyish and, you know, wears suits rather than, you know, feminine outfits because she doesn't want to look, quote unquote, weak.
Yeah. I mean, there's this tension throughout the book of her trying really hard to not seem like someone who would do that. But we also find it's really easy for people to assume that she is putting it out like that because of the success she's had in various ways, right? Especially with her relationship with Shinoi, her source, who, like, I was really glad to see that it stayed platonic. Like, I was really, like, worried it was going to, like, play into... This is when I still thought this was, like, a serial killer thriller, where, like, is he going to play into, like, is he going to either die at the end, or is he going to, like, you know, are they going to, like, hook up somehow? And I'm glad that the book didn't go that route. The ending is actually quite wholesome once we get to it. But definitely, like, the reason there's this tension, the reason why she's so worried about how people might see her relationships with her sources, with how she does her job, is because it's so easy. We see it happen several times throughout the book that people do assume that that's how she gets ahead.
Yeah. And she finds out later on that it doesn't matter what she does with her appearance. It doesn't matter what explanations that she has. If people are going to be jealous of women's success, they're going to come up with whatever theory that they want. And it's the same thing with Kaji. People are going to assume whatever they like about her crimes or supposed crimes, because they have their own, you know, projections on her, on what a woman should be, on what counts as being attractive. And, you know, like, I found it really interesting there, Rika and Kaji's first meeting, because Kaji straight up says, there's two things I can't tolerate: margarine and feminism. And I was like, oh, okay, I know exactly what type of person you are.
Yeah, I mean, what is your read on Kaji? Is she a sociopath, or is she just, like, so, like, bought into her idea of, like she's essentially like a trad wife, not influencer, but, like, she is part of that lifestyle. She believes that, like, she is bought into the idea that a woman's place is to support men. And that is, like, the pinnacle of female achievement and, like, feminism in the form of, like, women having careers, women having their own, you know, ambitions is, like, the worst. It's just as bad as margarine, which is just, like, fake butter.
It's funny because she talks about how she hates women who are, you know, career focused, who, you know, don't, quote unquote, take care of their men. And she, you know, like, when people are anti-women, they think about, like, how women are, like, the weaker sex and they're not, like, capable of leading. They're not capable of making their own choices. That's why the patriarchy and the government needs to make choices for them. However, Kaji, she straight up says, like, men are weak, okay? Like, they will not take care of themselves. They don't know how to. So it is up to us women to make sure that they stay alive by giving them home-cooked meals, by giving them the support that they need to have to fill their insecurities, because otherwise they're going to die and then we'll be blamed for it. So it is. So she's not like she's not criticizing women for being weak. It's quite the opposite. So it is a very funny take on anti-feminism.
But it still comes from a place that like men are the most important thing in this world.
Oh,
and we
yeah.
must protect them. Right. And I also found it interesting that this book, you know, it's about feminism in general. It's about enjoying life and food, but it's also about like the male loneliness epidemic, right? Like all of her.
Explain as a man.
I mean, all of her. So a running theme in this book is kind of men can't handle being alone. And, you know, we find out this is kind of the source of one of the sources of Rika's fascination with Kaji, which is the death of her own father and her own guilt associated with it, right? Like her father also passed away due to circumstances kind of similar to Kaji's quote-unquote victims, right? Because we never really confirm that she kills them, but she does kind of kill them through like their own loneliness. And I mean, we can talk more about like what we think her culpability in their deaths are, but like all the men, or at least the way that I read it in the novel, is like the men all kind of freaked out when Kaji stopped paying attention to them, right? And we find out later on that it's because she started taking classes at this cooking school, made female friends for the first time, and in a way decided to focus on herself for a bit, right? Not serve them, not make them the center of her world, and they couldn't handle it. And again, this is all could be smoke and mirrors, because everything Kaji does and says you have to take with a grain of salt. Like, a part of me still thinks that she is, because she is based on like a real life con woman. So like a part of me is like, did she con them? Or is she like sincere in her belief in like a woman's place? Because that is also a little like, you know, it is a little nuts, right? Because I don't know. I think personally for me, I don't know that you can be wholeheartedly invested into like this traditional trad wife persona without a little bit of like, you're doing this for like a grift.
Yeah, it's so she has a blog, and I just thought that was so funny to me, because this is like before, I mean 2017, I guess, and like just considering how it may have taken years for Asako to finish this book, but like trad wives weren't really promoting themselves on Instagram at that point. So mommy blogs and like cooking blogs were like very much in vogue during this time. And just the way she writes it, it's like she's trying so hard to look like she doesn't care about her appearance and like the way she even like dishes her food, because the photos are bad, her tableware is bad, and it's like she cares so much about the brand of butter she uses and like these very like high-end ingredients, but she's like slapdashingly putting stuff out there on social media being like, look at me, I don't care about how I'm perceived. And I'm like, you absolutely care how you are being perceived. You are a narcissist, and this is just like a way for you to spin yourself as someone who doesn't care. It's very like curated.
Yeah, right. And that's why I think it's hard to take anything she says at face value, especially because like she has never met someone in this book that she did not want to manipulate, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's just like a classic narcissistic take. Yeah, so yeah, so like Rika gets in touch with Kaji because she takes Reiko's advice on asking her about the recipe that she used for a beef stew. And that was like the last thing that her last victim ate before he passed away. So Kaji absolutely like, you know, cannot resist, because, you know, she is literally starved
for like culinary gastronomic experiences behind bars. So she's like, this person is my my eyes, my mouth in the real world. So she can't resist.
It's like her one hobby, and she needs to have that outlet to experience it through someone else.
Yeah, and Rika, like, you know, she kind of approaches food in a way of like, I don't eat unless someone makes me eat, and I don't cook at all.
Yeah, I think it's a really, like, I think this part seemed like a commentary on the, just how, like, Japanese corporate culture makes everyone into drones, and, like, you kind of stop enjoying life because everything's wrapped around work and advancement, and her as a woman in a, you know, quote-unquote man's world, she has to, like, be twice as, you know, robotic, right? Twice as efficient in order to succeed. And I think this is the part of the book that I enjoyed. I think it's polarizing from what I read on the Goodreads reviews. A lot of people thought, like, the food descriptions and descriptions of, like, the non-crime stuff was, like, a little gratuitous, a little, like, meandering. But I think Asako does a really great job capturing the feelings of, like, why would someone enjoy eating something? What makes something like soaked in butter so good? And it also captures kind of like the secret of like fine dining, especially French fine dining. It's like, this is a ton of butter in it. That's the reason why it tastes so good.
Yeah, I mean, this book is definitely a commentary on how Japanese people view pleasure and view like bodies, not just women's bodies, but like men's bodies as well. And, you know, their depiction of what they think self-restraint should look like, what an ideal employee looks like. And they kind of put suffering as like a good thing. It's a good trait for you to be thin, to look overworked, to be too busy to not cook. Like, these are all ideal traits for an employee.
There's that one line by Makoto when he was complaining about his favorite idol in like that girl group that he likes, which is like, oh, I'm so mad at her for gaining weight because that means she's not putting in effort.
Yeah. And it's weird because people, when people think about like women's bodies, they might think like, oh, it's sexual, right? It's all about like what men want women to look like for their own pleasure. But it's also a way for women to have one form of control in the system that makes so many choices for them. And it's like, well, this is the one thing that I can control, one way that I can easily be accepted by the mainstream. All I have to do is be thin and conform. And it's not that hard to like put on a little bit of weight, like 1 kilo, 2 kilos, and then have the whole world say you're a pig, because that kind of system allows for people to look at your body as not an individual body, but as like a representation of the entire company or like your family or whatever community you're a part of. Is like, okay, well, you're representing everybody else. So the way that you're looking right now is not, it doesn't look great for us. And it's like, okay, that's a little weird, but
it's extreme.
This is
weird.
With like a very American lens.
Yeah. But I mean, so through her experiences with Kaji trying to, you know, soften her up so she can get the exclusive interview, she starts essentially experiencing, like, she gets sent on missions by Kaji to experience the joys of food. And we start with like butter, rice, and soy sauce, which is a classic comfort food dish in Japan, apparently, according to Shoro Nakajima, one of the top chef people I follow, who did post a butter, soy sauce, rice recipe recently. And then, you know, she kind of discovers that, like, hey, I like it when things taste good. I like it when I make something to feed myself, and I am enjoying this experience, and in the process starts gaining some weight, right? And this is when there's so many comments, right? Especially from her boyfriend Makoto, if you can call him that, right? They're kind of like more like friends with benefits at this point,
like situationship at this point. Yeah,
but He's the one that complained about how his favorite idol gained some weight, and like, he's mad at her for like not putting the effort. And he kind of makes similar comments to her too, right? Like, hey, you're kind of putting on some weight. Like, are you not like serious about work anymore? Right? Or something to that effect. I don't remember the exact quote, but like kind of questioning her commitment because she's gaining weight.
Yeah. And it's really hypocritical because men in the same position as her, you know, gaining weight is kind of a sign of, oh, you're doing your job. You're like, you know, participating in the late night entertaining of clients. Like, it means that you are, you know, out there networking. And for women, it's like you have to look conventionally attractive at all times. You have to be demure. You have to be thin. You have to be able to go above and beyond to be of service to men. And it's like there are so many defaults. They just want a woman that is like a template. They don't really care about your individual traits. And it's just so hypocritical because men get to do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah.
Want in the same position. Yeah.
We were discussing this on the Discord, which is like, are there any passages where like the men are being judged for how they look? I think the only character who is like judged for how he looks is Yokota, who is like the fourth potential victim that kind of got saved when Kaji was, quote unquote, saved, because we don't know if Kaji was actually a murderer or not, but the kind of stay at home, he wasn't a hikikomori, or he was more like a...
No, he had a job. He was a job, actually, right? Like, yeah.
But he was definitely like someone who like could not take care of himself, right? As a single person.
Well, there were descriptions of men's bodies throughout this book being like, oh, they must have been really handsome and fit when they were younger and they've grown soft with age, but it's like it made them more approachable. And I'm like, isn't that the same fucking thing with, you know, Rika gaining weight? Like, isn't, like, people's metabolisms changed, people's life situations changed. Like, why is it that a little bit of weight being gained by a man is seen as approachable and successful, and for a woman, it's not? So, yeah. But Rika goes on this journey where, you know, she's not only like cooking her own food, Kaji is like sending her on like these deranged, unhinged missions. Like, oh, you need to eat this specific chain ramen at like 4 a.m. after you have sex with someone. It's like the best thing ever. And she actually follows through and does it. And was like, that's a little much.
I mean, truly, Kaji is like the proto Instagram influencer or TikTok influencer, right? Let me show you a hidden gem, or let me show you a hack for the best ramen ever, right? And like, if this took place in like 2025, Kaji would definitely be like trad wife foodie influencer, right?
Yeah, and it is funny that, you know, Kaji has her flock of worshippers, like she says, like she has supporters, and people, whether they hate her or like love her, they think that there is this magnetism about her. There is this charisma, despite her not looking conventionally attractive. But Rika later on, she says, like, I thought you were special, but you're not, because all you had was time and money to cultivate your tastes. And anyone with time and money would be as cultured, be as sophisticated with their palate as you. So you're not special. And you like a lot of the luxury brands, not because they're actually good. Maybe some of them are, but you just like it because of status.
Yeah. And in like from a certain point of view, like even her role as like the caretaker, the trad wife, she was also a failure in that because her men all died.
Yeah. And, you know, she had a dream of getting married and, you know, being a mother. And it's just kind of weird because I'm like, you could have easily done that. But you continue to have these relationships with your clients.
But that is assuming that she actually wanted that trad wife life and this wasn't a grift or con, right? Because that's also like on the table, too, which is like, is she actually serious about this life, or is she using the trappings of trad wife culture to get what she wants, which is like money to go eat at fancy restaurants and do what she wants.
Yeah. And that kind of indulgence is seen as a sin in Japanese society. And which is why like people are so like immediate in their negativity towards Rika gaining weight, because they're like, oh, you're not exercising. You're not putting in the effort of losing weight. And if you're enjoying, if it seems like you're enjoying life too much, you are just not life maxing to the full to the fullest, you know. And this book is very much about like discovering how much is enough for you, what is a good amount for you, what your own tastes are, like what do you want out of life apart from what society expects of you, and how do you navigate that without you know, self-loathing and descending into this spiral that Reiko kind of goes through.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about Reiko's own journey? Because she has her own adventure in the background of Rika's quest, which I was surprised in how like much, how involved she ended up being, right? Like, were you surprised that she was seeing Kashi behind Rika's
back? Oh, no, absolutely not. No. Because maybe it's because I've seen a lot of true crime documentaries, and a lot of the amateur detectives are people who, you know, have a lot of spare time at home and are kind of bored with their lives. And, you know, like her friend is interviewing a serial killer or a possible serial killer. How can you not get invested in that? How do you not use the internet as like your resource and like get really into it? And it seems like Reiko is the type of person who like goes on extremes. Like, even though she was really competent at her PR job, people still didn't like her because they're like, you are unhinged, like you take things too far. And I was just like, yeah, she's gonna take that approach with this case. So I was not surprised that she went to go see Kaji. And I was also not surprised that there was this kind of tension and jealousy over Rika spending time with Kaji and kind of absorbing her bullshit philosophy on food and men and a woman's place in the world.
Right. But Kaji also kind of played Reiko like a fiddle too, which leads me to believe more in the camp that like Kaji knows what she's doing. She is definitely like grifting and not like a true believer in her cause, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you would think that Reiko and Kaji would, you know, there's a lot of similarities. They're both like really good cooks. They are determined to be a homemaker, but but Reiko, it seems like she's doing it as rebellion, right? Rebellion against her parents' non-traditional open relationship marriage. And it's not so much that she believes in, you know, traditional like trad wife philosophies, but it's just like, this is what my parents did. I don't really subscribe to it, so I'm going to go the other way. It's a very extreme personality.
Yeah, I think it's also, like you mentioned, like she does everything 110%. So like, if she's going to be a housewife, she's going to be the best housewife ever. And the fact that like it's actually causing her marriage to fall apart and like she's not getting what she wants out of it, even though she's doing everything quote unquote right. And seeing Kaji be so beloved by all these like men who like, even though like she's like not a good person, like also I think Reiko's worldviews are being challenged like at every turn here. And, you know, also combined with that, her jealousy with Kaji becoming friends with, or with Rika's obsession, growing obsession with Kaji and her point of view. And something that some more book club members mentioned was like, they kind of wish that like Rika and Reiko were endgame in this book, which I get, because like they do put down some like
sapphic
romantic, yeah, sapphic tension, yeah. Which I think it's, you know, it's par for the course whenever you in Japanese media, at least from what I've seen in like, you know, from anime and stuff, with like when you have a prince trope, right? Because the prince of the girl school is like a well beloved like shoujo trope, right? There's always like that piece of like sapphic tension, but it's always like, I find, unless it's outright a yuri, like a girl's love story, it's almost always queer baiting, right?
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to use the word queer baiting because, I mean, you don't know someone's sexuality just by their looks and behavior. And I don't know, I think it's really par for the course when you go to an all-girls school for pretty much your entire life up until like mixed co-ed university, you like, you're looking for substitutes, and you know, it's I like don't know, it's like sometimes there are characters who are like, oh, I really like women who, you know, can pass for men, like that is just what they are attracted to, versus other people who are just like, oh, like there's no men in this area, so I'm just going to latch on to the closest thing possible. So I think those are two totally different things. So
yeah,
can't really say queer baiting, but yeah, it is beloved. And because Rika and Reiko, they kind of have similar not upbringings, because Reiko grew up in like a very like rich household with loving parents, whereas Rika had like an abusive father who her mom divorced, and her mom became a single working mom. So that's, there's differences in that, but both of them went to all girl schools, and I feel like in those types of settings you bond so intensely with other girls. So in a lot of cases, like your relationship with your girl best friend is going to be stronger than your husband. So I'm not like too surprised that there is like this intensity between Rika and Reiko that can be read as like romantic. But yeah, I hesitate to call it like romantic. I think it's,
yeah,
there's definitely like sapphic undertones to it, but love doesn't have to be romantic. It can also be worship. It can be like adoration. It can be platonic. Yeah, it can be a lot of things.
Yeah. What did you think about Reiko's excursion into becoming essentially Yokota's mom / housekeeper?
It was interesting because, you know, she goes thinking that Yokota is the child molester who assaulted assaulted Kaji's younger sister.
Yeah.
And is the reason why Kaji became a serial killer. So she's like going there to collect evidence, but she ends up playing house. She ends up competing with Kaji, being like, oh, Kaji was with Yokota for 4 days before she was arrested, and she had him wrapped around her finger. I can totally do that. And she is severely disappointed because Yokota wants really nothing to do with her when she shows up at his doorstep, and she's not the kind of girl that he was talking to online. And even though she's doing all these services like cleaning and cooking for him, there's like no gratitude whatsoever. And she realizes that this feeling of emptiness that she's having at Yokota's place is the same feeling that she's having at her own household with her husband. She just feels unfulfilled and just resentful. And that's kind of when she has her real mental breakdown. And thankfully, she has a support network who, you know, like gets her to a separate home outside the home that she shares with her husband. She has time to like really reflect and stuff. And that's not something that a lot of people have.
Yeah. I mean, during this time, throughout the book, she is trying to get pregnant because that's what you're supposed to do when you become a wife and a homemaker. And, you know, she's going through all these fertility treatments, doing all these, like, there's that one scene where basically she's saying that her husband refuses to get tested to see if he's the one that has a problem, right? And then later on, Rika is talking to Ryosuke, and he confesses that, like, he's actually just worried that if it turns out that he can't, he's the problem, that they can't have a child together because of him, that she'll leave him. And it's like a very, like, kind of, oh, this isn't about, like, being macho. This is about male fragility with you. Like, you're afraid that you are not man enough.
Yeah, and also, it made me, like, wonder because the reason why Reiko has a hard time accepting her parents' marriage is because it was open and they were seeing a lot of other people. And, you know, when she confronts her parents about it when she's a teenager, her dad says, I can't have sex with someone that I see as family. And her husband pretty much says the same thing to her. And it's hard for me as a reader to discern whether or not, like, he actually meant that or like, or he was just masking, like, being like, well, I'm insecure about, you know, my virility. And I'm just going to say this and not mean it at all. So it's hard to say. But I do know that there's a lot of marriages in Japan where marriage is just like a status symbol. Like, there is no sexual chemistry at all.
I mean, it's one of the reasons why there's a declining birth rate, right? It's just like kids, people just aren't having kids for various reasons.
Yeah, and people blame women for that, being like, oh, it's because of, like, their career. It's because of, you know, like, we are putting this pressure on women to be, to have it all. And I'm like, okay, but you don't have the system to support people who want to have families. Like, your economy is shit, and you're not giving women, like, the same pay as men. They're not getting the same leniency when they get pregnant. In fact, if they get pregnant, they get fired or they don't get hired.
Your
so
policies,
it's like, is it really that people, like, don't want to have kids, or is it your policies
that's
preventing people from having kids?
In this way, it's a parallel to the themes in Kim Ji-young, which is like, yeah, it's, you know, if you want women to be happy and have families and, like, enjoy life, you need to provide them with, like, the ability to, and because if you deprive them of that, if you tell them your role is this, then they're just not going to participate.
Also, if men are going to be like, oh, I'm not going to do anything in the house, I need like 3 meals a day and it has to be made from scratch, blah blah blah, it's just like, who is gonna want to have the energy to take care of a child on top of that? You're already taking care of a child. So it's just like, men have to do better in order for women to, like, want to actually procreate and be moms and homemakers.
And that, like, that mindset is actually what probably killed all the men in this book. Like, the three victims of Kaji, as well as Rika's dad, right? We learn about Rika's father as we go about the investigation, because Rika finds out that Reiko's been spilling the beans about her tattoo to Kaji. That's how she knows.
Dude, that was, right? Like, the greatest betrayal in my opinion. Like, people thought that Kaji's betrayal to Rika at the end, like, coming out with, like an article saying, oh, like, Rika's articles are fake, like, I never said those things, here's my tell-all, and I'm gonna be coming out with a book. Like, people thought that that was, like, the greatest betrayal in this book, but I'm like, no, the greatest betrayal was Reiko spilling the beans about Rika's trauma to a manipulative, narcissistic serial killer.
Yeah, one of our newest book club members, Blake, was asking us, like, did anyone see that betrayal coming? And, like, I hadn't read the book to that point yet, so I didn't know what the betrayal meant. So I was thinking, like, oh, is she going to, like, manipulate her to, like, you know, or one of her friends to, like, die? Or I was still thinking this was going, like, Silence of the Lambs, kind of, like, more like serial killer thriller. But when it turned out to be just, like, a rival article, kind of debunking everything that Rika wrote in her, like, hit article, I was like, you know what? This actually makes a lot of sense, because there's no way a narcissist, manipulator, grifter like Kaji would ever allow something to like besmirch her, like her reputation as like, you know, a strong trad wife woman.
Yeah. And I mean, besmirch, I feel like Rika's article has actually humanized her quite a bit because it goes into her childhood. It goes into her home, you know, hometown, like what made her like this. And I feel like the public wouldn't have had that context without Rika. So,
yeah, but also like Kaji, like, hates vulnerability, right? Does not want to, like, she's definitely a textbook narcissist, which is like, she can't have anything out there that portrays her as weak, right? Her strength does not come from weakness. It comes from her steadfast belief that this is how a woman should act. This is how a woman should serve her men, right?
And you know, that belief comes from her parents as well. I was very, like, intrigued by how everyone's childhood trauma with their parents really shaped their worldview on like feminism and patriarchy, because the reason why like Kaji hates other women and believe that a woman should be like a wife and a homemaker and that's like the end all be all for women is because her mom was a career woman. Her mom, you know, was ambitious and, you know, didn't really know how to cook well. And, you know, like Kaji saw that as selfish and saw that as, you know, her not loving her father enough. And then like with Makoto, you know, he grew up in a single mother household, the same as Rika. And, you know, he feels like any type of meal that is made from scratch is like sacrifice. He's like, oh, they're not making this because they want to. They're making it to make me feel better or to, you know, say that they're sorry or like there's like some hidden meaning behind this meal. Like when Rika makes pasta for herself and he's like, hey, can I come over for the night because I missed the last train? She's like, yeah, sure. And, you know, she makes him a plate of pasta and he's like, it's OK, but you didn't have to do this for me. And she's like,
I made this pasta for me.
I just thought it would be a courteous thing to do, you know, to feed my boyfriend. Like, why are you making this like a big statement? And it's because of his childhood trauma with his mom.
Yeah. And, you know, we also learn about Rika's childhood trauma with her dad, which you know, we mentioned is relayed to Kaji through Reiko, which is like her dad went down like a spiral after separating with his mom and couldn't take care of himself and was the type of person that you see the similarities between her dad and Kaji's victims, which is like they all kind of died through neglect, right? Not taking care of themselves. And, you know, we learned that Rika's dad was kind of making it a point like, oh, you don't want to be with me. Now look at how bad my life is. Look at how unhealthy I am. Look at how like I'm not taking care of myself. This is because I'm alone now because you left me. And that's kind of the message he was trying to give. Or at least that was how it was being interpreted. And there's that scene where Rika recounts her mom being the target of a lot of the neighbor gossip, which is like, oh, look at how she's letting her ex-husband wallow like that. How could she do that? Like, that's not what a wife should do.
Yeah. And why is it that her mom is being blamed for a grown man's self-neglect? It's like, can't he, like, he can definitely cook, like, even if it's boiling water and ramen, like he can survive. You could at least like know how to clean your sink. The reason why Rika, you know, like she had promised her father, oh, I'm going to make you.
It was like a gratin, well, right?
Yeah, gratin or something. And he's like, I learned this in a home economics class because it turns out that Rika did love cooking when she was younger, that she was very adept at cooking. And, you know, she tells her father this and her father's like, oh, like, can you come over and make that for me on Friday? And she's like, yeah, sure. But once Friday comes around, she's thinking about all the labor that she has to do before cooking the food for her father. And it's just way too much for her. And she's like, I'm tired. I just had volleyball practice. I don't feel up to doing this. So she lies to her dad saying, hey, I have a test coming up. Like, I don't think I can come over. And instead of being a mature adult saying, okay, that's fine, he straight up says, do you think I'm stupid? Like, you're just like your mom. You're a liar. And I hate you. Blah, blah, blah. Hangs up. He has a stroke. No one discovers his body for 3 days. And the person who discovers his body is his daughter. And she thinks that if she had been there to make the gratin and, you know, like, been a good daughter by providing for him, which I think is ridiculous, because why are you parentifying a child? He wouldn't have had, his body wouldn't be undiscovered. Like, she would have at least seen the signs of a stroke and gotten him hospitalized. Like, she has this guilt, this trauma on cooking and men who are neglectful of their health until they die. And that's why she's fascinated with Kaji. And the fact that, like, Kaji is the reason why she starts venturing more into cooking is really fascinating to me, because it's so close to her trauma.
Yeah, because, like, another major theme of this book is, like, hey, life is meant to be enjoyed. You should, like, do what makes you happy. And you should, you know, you don't have to live by society's rules if it's, like, making you miserable. And, you know, through her, like, at first, Kaji seems to be the embodiment of this, right? Like, she does what she wants. She eats what she wants. Like, she enjoys the act of, like, fine dining. She, like, enjoys eating and stuff. And later on, you realize through the investigation that, like, Kaji herself is trapped in her own set of rules, right? We find that, like, she can't function if there's nothing, if there's no recipe, if there's no list of things to do, right? She is incapable of improvising, right? And that's kind of, like, at the end of the book when Rika decides to, like, improvise to make something with the turkey's leftovers, which, again, this is, like, our second book this year that involved the making of a American turkey dinner. Right?
Remind me, what was the first book that
Reeve.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah.
I forgot the owner's name, but, like, when the master is dating the American girl and, like, oh, I want to make you a traditional Thanksgiving dinner, and they go through the whole rigmarole. I think this is the second book, and this is something that Cup of Jen, our book member, also pointed out. Like, this is the second turkey roasting story this year that goes into, like, the whole process of preparing and roasting a turkey. I think this one definitely captures, like, the anxiety of, like, someone who's not sure how to cook a turkey, and, like, the fear that, like, I sure hope people don't get salmonella from the bird I roasted. Right?
Yeah, and the reason why Rika gets this recipe, this turkey recipe, is because she goes undercover at the culinary school that Kaji went to. And this is the school where Kaji learned to cook French cuisine and, you know, attempted to make female friends, which is, you know, hilarious considering that she always talks about how she hates other women. She hates feminism. She thinks that, you know, she's better than other women and she doesn't care about other people's opinions. But she desperately wants to be one of the girls in this group who are, you know, like, affluent, stylish women with time and money to spare. And she's like, she desperately wants to belong with them. And it's just hilarious because she's just like, oh, like, what do you cook for your husband? Like, what do you do for your husband to, like, be in this, like, happy marriage? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, like, do you care about your husband's preferences for this? And, like, the women are so fed up. They're like, hey, I come to class to learn how to cook, and I don't really give a shit about what men think. So the fact that you're bringing this energy to class, not appreciated.
Yeah, I think this is where the book kind of puts a doubt on, like, whether or not Kaji is a sociopath serial killer, right? Because you find that, like, while she was at this cooking school is when she starts cooking for herself and kind of, like, spending time away from the men that she was romancing, that she was servicing. And in a way, that's what led to them, her men, having their crash outs and eventually dying in mysterious accidents, right? Like someone, one of them jumped in front of a train or fell into train tracks. One of them had a stroke, right? One of them had like a heart attack.
I don't remember all the deaths.
Yeah.
I do remember one of them hanging themselves. Like there was one that was like, oh, that is a suicide. Like that.
Yeah.
If that is a murder, it was definitely staged as a suicide.
Because the MO for like a lot of the, for all the deaths were like, at some point she stops paying attention to them and they all kind of freak out about it, right?
Yeah. And speaking of freak out, this is like at this cooking school, this is when Kaji has her own freak out because, you know, it's a French cooking school. So they cook French cuisines. And the madame, the teacher of the school, says, OK, well, like for fun, like tell me what you guys want to cook. Tell me what you guys want to eat and we'll make it. It doesn't matter if it's Vietnamese or, you know, Korean, like it doesn't have to be French. And one of the ladies says, oh, I want to cook a turkey, like an American turkey for Thanksgiving. And Kaji freaking loses it because she's like, that's not French. And also, like, I practice cooking at home. Like, how can I practice cooking a turkey? Like, turkey serves 10 people. Like, I can't do that, like, at home. Like, I don't have the equipment, blah, 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 blah. And she freaks out. And then she destroys the kitchen and leaves the cooking school and then realizes that she can't go back because she caused such a scene. And she invites the women at her cooking school as to like an apology turkey dinner. But the women are just like, we're not going. They tear up their invitations. Kaji never finds out because she gets arrested at Yokoda's place. And it was at Yokoda's place that she was cooking the turkey. And this is when Rika pieces everything together, being like, you do care about other people's opinions and you're angry because you were never accepted by these women. And guess what? I'm going to be making a turkey for me and I'm going to be inviting all the people that matter to me. And I'm going to have this dinner that you never fully realized and actualized yourself. So it's goodbye.
It's such a good climax, right? Because it's her kind of overcoming, like surpassing this woman that she was unhealthily obsessed with and like kind of realizing that like I know how to find my own like happiness. Like I know what makes me happy, which is like being around the people that I care about, cooking for them, and like in a way succeeding where Kaji failed, right? Because she is actually like kind of keeping them like, because like I mean, unless something goes wrong, she's not killing any of her friends with her cooking.
No.
Right?
No. And I do love how food brings people together in Rika's life, and it enriches her life. It makes her question, you know, her own tastes and figure out like, what is a good amount for me? Like I'm finding out that I can't eat that much rich food because now I'm getting like indigestion and I have to go to the hospital. I'm discovering what pleasure in cuisine is like, but obviously I've overindulged. So what is the good amount for me? What is a good amount for me to be this committed to the case without going off to the deep end? What is good enough for me? Like, what am I willing to do in this career to get ahead without compromising my, it's like my personal morals?
Yeah.
So this book is all about like autonomy and gaining, you know, like figuring out what makes you happy and how to go about it in your own way that doesn't betray you.
I also love that what makes her happy is being the clubhouse friend, right? The friend whose house is like, is the place everyone hangs out at.
Yeah. 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 It's community. It's something that Kaji wished she had, but doesn't. And I do love how at the end, Rika's like, I'm probably not going to lose this weight. Like, it's okay. Like I enjoy eating and, you know, I don't have to, I don't want to be malnourished. I don't want to be thin just to be taken seriously at work. My work will speak for itself. Yeah. And that is like really refreshing because of just how much toxicity there is around Japanese women's bodies.
Yeah, I mean, she finds herself in a good place. Like, she starts to, like, you know, she starts to disentangle things that she thought she needed to do because of society, right? She breaks up with Makoto because she realized that this isn't a real relationship. Like, they're together because they feel like they should be, because, like, it's convenient, but it's not, like, there's nothing here. There's no foundation here for, like, a long-lasting relationship. He has a semi-crash out when that happens, but then he comes around, thankfully, and kind of is there for her when she is, like, you know, in the pits after Kachi kind of, like, blindsided her with the rival, like, with essentially, like, her slanderous rebuttal to her article, which is at the same time written by the new man that she is romancing, even though she's still in jail.
Yeah, and also, like, this is where Rika is getting the receiving end of all the hateful comments that were thrown at Kaji for being ugly, for being being fat, being, you know, like, not conforming, because they're saying all the same comments to Rika, and Rika's like, oh, if they thought I was fat then, I'm really fat now. So like, it can be, like, really depressing when, you know, you kind of get sucked in by these negative comments, and those are the loudest voices. Like, in reality, a lot of people really liked her articles, and it, you know, gave her an opportunity to show off her writing chops, and she's now going to be writing a book about all the women that Kaji fucking messed up. And, like, she's like, I don't know if this is gonna make my career better or not, but it's what I want to do, and why not? I mean, it's not like I'm doing any serious writing at my job right now, so what is there to risk? So I love how she chooses to not lose weight, to not conform, to go her own way.
And it was good to see that her company was, you know, essentially in the background, still had her back, right? They put her on, like, administrative leave, right? Nothing, like, forward facing, but they didn't fire her for, like, the backlash.
Okay, but that is, like, so Japanese, though. It's so hard to get fired from a company. Like, I don't know if you've heard stories about Konami on how, like, people would not, you know, get fired or, like, promoted. They will just, like, send them to, I don't know, like, be a janitor. And it's like, that's their career now because they made, like, a small mistake in, like, software. And it's just like, you hear stories like that and you're like, okay, you might not be fired because that might be too much for the company. And they don't want to pay, like, severance or whatever. So they're just going to keep you in this miserable dead end job until you quit. And even then, they'll be like, actually, you can't quit because we don't want you to leave and spill company secrets or whatever. So it's very hard to get fired in Japan and to get to move jobs. There's actually agencies where you hire someone, a professional, to break up with your employer so you can move on to a different job. Ugh. Because a lot of these employers will go after their former employees and try to besmirch their reputation. It's intense.
maybe not a silver lining, but I did appreciate that she did build this found family around her that comes together in the turkey dinner. I was pleasantly surprised that, like, you, like, her junior, didn't turn out to be, like, an antagonist. Like, she kind of ends up looking up to her for, like, doing, like, her job well, because at first she was a little, like, you know, you get the feeling that you kind of saw her as competition in a way, right?
I mean, like, I didn't really get antagonistic rival vibes from you, but it was really sweet that you volunteered to, like, help out with the turkey dinner. She was, like, the first to you know, tell Rika, like, hey, I admire you, like, don't read the hate comments, like, never read the comments, I'm a Gen Z-er, like, believe me, you don't want to go there. She's also the one who is into the same idol group as Makoto. And yeah. She outs Makoto as like a girl group fan. And she's like, yeah. And she's just like, oh, did you know that he like dropped support of his bias of this girl group because she gained weight because she hit puberty and now everyone hates her and he just can't, you know, it's just too much for him. And I was like, oh, girl, you're spilling the tea.
But then Rika's the one that calls him on, like, you only don't like her because everyone else doesn't like her. Like, you need to be confident in your own convictions that this person is your favorite. Like, be a grown man about it. And then it was nice to see that she did get through to him because he did like eventually, like, because when he comes to take care of, bring her dinner when she's in down the dumps, he's coming back from like the farewell concert of his bias. And he's like, yeah, like, you're right. Like, I need to like what I like and not care what other people think, which is nice. I think they had a good, like, you know, even though they're not end game, I like that they ended in like a reconciled position with each other.
Yeah. I feel like they really, you know, took each other's words like, you know, it's just like, okay, let me, this isn't just like a breakup.
Yeah. One of the few like male-female relationships that like had like a healthy end to it.
I like, speaking of like healthy male-female relationships in this book, I really like Shinoi and Rika's relationship as mentor and mentee. And also just, you know, I was really worried that he was going to turn out to be like this creepy superior who, you know, like eventually takes advantage of
the
bright-eyed ingenue.
There were so many flags, right? Like when she goes to his house to like bake the cake and he's like,
I was so worried. Oh my God. And like her being like, oh, like my boob brushed up against his bicep, but I can't move away because otherwise he'll know that I noticed. And, you know, we need to play. Yeah. We need to be like casual about it. And I'm like, girl, you're overthinking it.
I'm glad that he was like very like platonic and cordial about it. He just wants to help her make this cake because she's doing it wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, him telling, like her telling him like, oh, I gained weight. Like that's the first thing she says to him when she, you know, meets him for like her source, like meets him to like pick up sources.
They're like clandestine meetup at like the corner diner.
Yeah. And he's just like, oh, I don't care about that kind of thing. And she's like, oh, that's weird because everyone else has been commenting on it and everyone else is saying that it's bad for my career. And he's just like, well, fuck those people. Like, ignore them. And you find out why he has this mindset. It's because his daughter was bullied for being overweight. And she wasn't even that overweight. She was just going through puberty like that idol that Makoto stands.
And that's the reason why he knows how to make a cake, because they used to make cakes together all the time. But then she stopped because she was being bullied for her weight. And it's like, I think the relationships also, like, it illustrates, like, you know, because we see a lot. The book is through Rika's point of view, and we see her overthinking, like, why is he so nice to me? Why is he providing me with these sources? What does he want out of it? Right? Because she is conditioned to think that help is conditional, right? There is a reason why he's doing this that goes beyond like, you know, professional, you know, mentorship. And I did like that she sort of asked him, like, hey, why are you doing this for me? Why are you sharing your sources? And he's pretty matter of fact, it's like, well, I can't use them because it's privileged information. So, like, if I can use it, I'd rather use it to help someone who, like, I think has promise.
Yeah. And also, like, because of this profession, they have to do a lot of, like, you know, nighttime entertaining, right? And there's a scene where Rika is at, like, a karaoke party with some of her, like, company colleagues. Some of them are from different departments. And there is a superior who gets a little too drunk and frisky with her, and she, you know, brushes him off, like a very like casual brush off, not even like very, not even aggressive. And the guy turns, you know, it's just like, oh, it's not like I wanted you anyway, pig. And it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Just from a slight show of rejection. And then the next day, He's like, oh, by the way, I was really drunk. I'm so sorry. But I'm like, that's not genuine at all. You knew exactly what you were doing. So I was very scared that Shnoi would be that type of superior. But he turns out to be a nice guy. He turns out to be a guy who, you know, has empathy and really wants people to do well, which is very rare in that industry, apparently.
Also a way for Rika to work through her own daddy issues, right? Because here is someone who is going through, went through a divorce, is kind of like not really taking care of himself, and like gives her, like in her mind, a chance for redemption of what she couldn't do for her own father. She later, you know, realized that this isn't like, she was also just like kind of reading too much into it. But I think I like the fact that he is part of the found family that comes to Rika's, you know, turkey dinner, and that offers him a way to reconnect with his daughter as well.
Yeah, and his daughter wants to be like, her daughter invites, his daughter invites herself to this dinner. She's like, wait, you're eating a turkey? I want to eat a turkey. Let me go. And I was just like, that's like really wholesome. And especially since she's going into school for, she's in school for nutrition. So she has turned her eating disorder into something that, you know, she can use to help, like, you know, she uses it as a way to empathize with other people and to bring, you know, like to have a healthier perspective on eating. And as someone who, I mean, this book, it's like rife with fat phobia, and not that America doesn't have fat phobia, because we do. I mean, currently look at the Ozempic crisis and look at like the Hollywood stars who are super thin now, but it's so much harsher in Asia. And I think there's this belief that all Asians are slim because that's what they see in the mainland, but I don't think people understand that there are a lot of girls in East Asia who have eating disorders because of pressures from society. And it's just like, I found it really relatable as someone who, you know, went through puberty and all that, and, you know, very used to Asian relatives and people in the community just commenting on everybody's bodies. So like, it was nice that there was people like Rika and Shinoi's daughter who's just like, it's okay to be a normal weight, because that's what humans are. Like, humans aren't meant to be like sticks. They're meant to, you know, be varying sizes. And that's like really refreshing. And like, it made me reflect on like my relationship with food and my relationship with like my body as like as someone who is like, you know, in their mid 30s. And, you know, like, I think about how like all throughout like my school years, I was like 15 to 20 pounds underweight, and I was like really praised for it. And I'm like, this is not in my control. Like, I'm actually trying to gain weight because my doctors are actually very worried that I am like I am underweight. But the beauty standard then was to be like very thin. It was like to be like size zero or whatever. And I went through puberty late. So once puberty hit, all of a sudden I'm like an average size and no longer like super thin. And it really affected how people saw me and people interacted with me. So I was like, okay, yeah, like this is relatable. And I'm the heaviest that I've ever been now. And sometimes that's like really hard because it's just like, oh, I'm not the same size or weight as I used to be in like high school or freshman year of college. But I'm like, but I'm also like, I'm a 30 something year old woman. I'm not supposed to be built like a teenager. That's just unrealistic standards that the patriarchy has thrown at women.
I think ultimately that's the central message of this book, which is like, hey, don't let society dictate what makes you happy or what you should or shouldn't be doing. You know, like, find your own happiness, find your own, like, there's you know, everyone's messed up in their own ways, probably because of their dads, based on this book, or their relationship with their parents. But you shouldn't let that like dictate how you live your life. Like, kind of find what makes you happy. Like, you know, if it's eating stuff with butter, then eat stuff with butter. But like, you know,
also, yeah, but don't eat too much. To the point that you get sick. All right, yeah. Like, enjoy your life, but don't make yourself sick over it.
I did like where this book ended up, like with Rika kind of figuring out her own, like what makes her happy, what is enough for her. I like that. In the end, it wasn't really about Kaji in the first place. Like her, the result of her, like, we don't even like, you know, find out whether or not she wins her appeals case or not. Probably not, because a lot of evidence is surfacing against her. But at the same time, like, I like that. I don't know if I liked it, but I didn't mind that we didn't have a clear conclusion on whether or not she was actually guilty of the crime she was accused of.
Yeah, because the crime that she's being accused of, like the thing that people actually care about is, you know, why are you ugly and fat? Like, that's the crime that people are caring most about, being like, how dare you think that you're attractive enough or charming enough to seduce these men to their death? The just like the arrogance of it. So it's not so much about like, oh, did she kill these men or not? It's just like society's reaction to her, yeah, as someone who is not conventionally attractive, or like what they believe femme fatales should look like. Yeah. This is also like a funny anecdote, but the actual like Konkatsu killer, Kane Kijima, she was also like really into cooking, and she did go to like a cooking school, just like Akaji in this book. And Yuzuki, the author of Butter, went to the school to take classes for research for this book. So another yeah, layer to the meta-ness of this book. I just thought it was really funny.
Yeah. And, you know, she played the perfect foil to our main character Rika in her journey of like self-discovery and coming up, like adult coming of age. Right. And like at the end, like I really enjoyed the book. I really, like, as someone who like does enjoy eating out, going to restaurants, like I liked all the descriptions of like the food. And I really do think that Asako captures that feeling of like, yeah, what does it feel like to, you know, bite into a rich, decadent meal? But I can also see where, like, you know, her, you know, this book is very like, it's very descriptive.
Yeah, after a while it can be like very tiring to read food descriptions and be like, okay, she's enjoying her food, I get it, but that feeling of feeling too full from her eating all this rich buttery food, that's intentional. So
yeah,
you're supposed to get fatigued by it. So I thought I didn't mind it at all.
Yeah.
With the long food descriptions.
Yeah. And I guess with that, you know, we've come to the end of our discussion of Butter. Is there anything we missed? I feel like we talked a lot, but was there, keep thinking.
I'm sure there's a lot of things that we've missed. This is a very thick book. This book was like close to 450 pages, I think. Yeah, like exactly 450 pages. And it's so funny that we mentioned Kim Ji-young Board 1982 at the beginning of this podcast, because that book came out in 2016, so a year before Butter came out. And that book is very short.
It's a tight book, yeah. I mean,
it's a tight book, so different deliveries on the same message.
Yeah, which is, you know, F the patriarchy. Just do what you want. Don't let what Confucius wrote like thousands of years ago dictate how you live your life, how you see the men and women of your life. Because in the end, the patriarchy screws us all.
Internalized misogyny is probably worse than just misogyny.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you have any thoughts on Butter by Asako Yuzuki or on our discussion of the book, please let us know either on our Goodreads forums or if you are a patron supporter on our Discord. We'd love to hear your feedback on our discussions whenever possible. But yeah, with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. We don't actually know what our next book club pick is going to be, because this episode is coming out on March 30th, and I really should have thought of this beforehand, but we have not actually chosen our April book club pick yet. So keep,
because it's your choices, audience, your patron choices.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this the day it comes out on the 30th, you still have one day to vote on what we will be reading for next month. But if you're not on Patreon, just keep a lookout on our social media or on our website. We will be announcing a book club pick on April 1st. It will not be an April Fool's joke because you're taking this. We take our book club very seriously. But you will know by April 1st what our next book club pick is. But yeah, with that, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Ri Ryu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former Beer League player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.